Welcome to the Admin Admin Podcast, a podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysadmin, working on the help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer tech who wants to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy. And we're at episode 24, and it's a bit of a milestone, this one, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. We're done a whole year. So we've released our first podcast a whole year ago on the 1st of July, and it's the 3rd of July today, so today about over a year. So, yeah.
It's gone so fast. And that's it, and 24 episodes, that's nearly one every 2 weeks, so that's basically on schedule. So it's averaged out pretty well.
So tonight we've got a guest, Dean. He emailed us in because we linked to his blog a couple of shows ago, and we've been emailing us backwards and forwards and kind of just persuaded him to come on the show to talk about what he does. So hi there, Dean.
Hi, guys.
So how's it going over that way?
Not too bad. Living in Manchester, so we've had 3 days of sun, which will equate to what we'll see for the rest of the year, I'm guessing. Looking a little bit bleaker out there today.
Yeah, so yes, it's been quite warm up here. Apparently on Wednesday it's the hottest day in Norfolk for 9 years, apparently. And I had a day off because we went to this thing, like a local show, like an agricultural show, and it was really hot. So luckily we had loads of sun cream, we didn't get burnt or anything. So yeah, so tell us a bit about yourself then, Dean. So what do you do in your day job, or what do you specialise in? Or
So bit of an odd one, really. There's no official job title to what I do now, but I'm essentially a technical architect. So I spend a lot of time going to customer sites, understanding the requirements, business objectives of the companies, and then matching them to a new infrastructure, redesign of what they've currently got. One of the great examples at the moment is I've been working with a leisure centre company for the past year. So they take on new leisure centres as and when they win bids or tenders for them, and at the same time they occasionally lose leisure centres. So I've put in place a framework for them to take that on, and from that framework they know what hardware they need, what services, software. So they've then been able to compute that down to a commoditised cost per user. So every time they take on a new leisure centre, say they've got 50 users, they know it costs them X amount of pounds per user. Means that it's easy for them to forecast what their outgoings are.
That's cool. So what technology do you normally deal with in VMware, I see? And
yeah, so personally, I've spent the last 5-6 years working in VMware. If my first job had been Citrix, I think I'd have been a Citrix bod more than anything. So it's down to that, really. Cisco UCS is my current flavour at the moment in terms of putting a lot of effort and designs behind that, mainly because it makes sense for a lot of companies. And the great thing as well is it's actually coming out a lot cheaper than what people expect. So obviously the Cisco name is quite a well-known name across everything, that old joke of nobody gets sacked for buying Cisco. But at the same time, everybody thinks it's a little bit expensive for me and I don't want to look at it. And I have the great pleasure of going to a lot of customers and saying, it's not actually as expensive as you think, and it makes sense.
Yeah. So how did you get into IT then, Dean?
So originally I worked in the car industry as such, working at various different roles for a parent company of multiple car industry companies, finance, leasing, purchasing, so forth. I trained to be a lawyer. I did my A-levels in law. I decided it wasn't for me, so I'd always been into IT ever since I was young. So I decided to go off to college, did a BTEC in that, which is the vocational, for anybody that's not from the UK. And then I decided to do my CCNA and all my comp tier exams whilst I was at the college, because they used to do that in the night time for adult learners for £500-600 per semester. So I convinced college to let me do it for free. And they added that on top of my course, and really the story goes from there. Went for my first interview, which was an implementation of ITIL-based service desk, and didn't really get the job to my IT knowledge. It was more down to the fact that I had really good customer services skills, and they needed to get people away from collaring engineers and technicians in the corridors and so forth, and emailing people directly and saying, hi, can you fix this, to actually using a proper service desk that could be based around SLAs and outcomes and monitored, which is something that I've not had before.
Ah, cool. So did you carry on to the same job to what job you're in today and then work your way up to there?
So that was only contract-based to begin with and just kept renewing the contracts over and over. And they ended up having a restructure within the team. Because it was coming up to Christmas, it was kind of a case of, right, okay, maybe I'm going to be out of my here. Been here for quite a while now. So I applied just for the service desk job there, just so it tidied me over Christmas. I knew I had an income coming in. Shortly after that, they had another restructure because it didn't go quite the way they wanted. A key member of staff that was probably going to get one of the top-level jobs there didn't get the job for whatever reason. So I thought, why not? Let's apply for it. Senior IT technician. I got the job, and then I spent the next, nearly 3 years looking after a huge VDI deployment on VMware Vue, Dell Blade chassis, full Cisco network, the usual stuff that comes with a full IT infrastructure. It was actually a college I worked for, so we had around 50 virtual servers alone just to run stuff, and then all the desktops on top of it. So I got to touch pretty much every technology possible.
Cool. That sounds interesting. So you were talking about this UCS then. So you started your blog, your latest blog post about it. I never really used the UCS. Were you kind of at work just used HP blade enclosures with high-powered blades in it? So is that kind of the same sort of thing with the Cisco UCSs then?
So I've had experience with the blade stuff. So if you want to go back on my blog, there's a bit of a blog calling them out on the way they do firmware updates and stuff like that, because it left me in a little bit of a pickle at particular customers once with the Flex 10 network modules and everything went offline. So the Cisco UCS, if you read into it, they kind of advertise it as stateless computing, but it's fully stateless to the point where if your blade chassis dies, you replace that hardware. And if you've got the configuration right when you boot it back up, if you're running VMware ESX or even Hyper-V, it will just carry on running because there is no hardware actually associated with the hardware, if that makes sense. So anything like MAC addresses, physical hardware, iSCSI, IQN identifiers, anything like that. It's all policy based, so you manually type it in and create pools of them, which is one of the reasons why I've been looking at it for some of my customers. Because in the future, if they ever have a failure, we can just ship them out a new blade, they replace it, plug it in. And what they're not doing is then paying for us as an engineer to go back on site to actually reconfigure everything, whether that takes a day, 2 days, 3 days, depending on how complex the setup is. So overall, it's cheaper for them. It means we lose out on a little bit of money because we're not sending an engineer to site getting paid for it. But in the long run, we're actually saving money for ourselves because we've got more dedicated engineer resources that we can send out on projects rather than just break fix stuff, which can be quite time consuming, as everybody knows in IT.
Yeah. So it's basically like a virtual, virtual blade then, is that what we're saying then? So it's like...
I guess so. I guess the UCS does for hardware what VMware did for the virtualization market in software. You are taking away that reliance on the physical hardware as such. Everything's profile-based, policy-based. So if you want to set up a blade and say, right, you've got 4 network adapters, you can only use 50% of the uplinks to the network through the blade chassis, you can deploy that. And then for your next 2 blades, maybe you want to say, right, okay, you can actually access the full networking and take it from there.
All right, cool. So that's really interesting. Yeah, because I've really used them. I mean, I've seen the blogs and stuff about them, but I've never had a chance to even play with them really. So
yeah, I think kind of the point of crossover for most people to start looking into them is when they brought out the UCS Mini, because originally when they brought out UCS, they were definitely aiming for the service provider market, hosting companies and so forth, because it had the 2 top of the rack switches that has the management software baked in. Mm-hmm. Now they have the UCS Mini, which is basically everything's within the chassis, which is similar to the way that the HP Blade chassis run, the Dell Blade chassis as well.
Yeah.
But the footprint's really small, so it's only 9U in total. All the licensing costs are included as well when you buy it. And once again, it's just a lot cheaper than what people expect for that Cisco brand name on top of it. And I think now as well, I think they're either number 2 in the American market for blade sales, the number 1 in Asia, I think the number 2 in Europe at the moment, but I'm pretty sure there'll be more figures coming out now as we go into the second quarter about where they are. But they've really been ripping up the HP business.
Mm-hmm. So you can then install whatever you want on this. You can install ESX, you can install VMware and or you can install Hyper-V. It's up to you what you want to install.
Yeah, so you can go Citrix, VMware, Microsoft. You can deploy physical servers on there. There's a lot of case studies coming out at the moment around Hadoop clusters that are certified on Cisco UCS. So Cisco actually have something called Cisco Validated Designs, which is essentially the networks and everything that they set up working with third-party vendors, whoever that may be, and certifying, you know, certain setups on there, and it gives you a blueprint to create your design off and your network and footprint to go forward with.
Cool. Have you done much of VMware 6 so far? Have you deployed VMware or Fez?
Yeah, we've got a couple out there at the moment. It's kind of a solid in some areas, not so solid in other areas. So for anybody out there that's actually thinking of deploying VMware ESX 6, at the moment, the biggest things is there was a CBT bug, which is change block tracking, straight away. That was addressed within a couple of weeks. So it's worth getting either onto my blog to find out about that or just Googling it as well. Just ESX 6.0 CBT will be enough to bring up the information for you. So once you've deployed the ESX, get that patch installed straight away. And the second one as well is when you're using the web client or you're using the C-sharp client, the Windows-based client, and you click that little box that says use Windows authentication details to connect, seems to fail. There's another KB out there to actually fix that. And if you give me a second to open up my emails, I could probably find the KB number for that as well. That's just a little niggly bug. So some of our customers have got monitoring scripts that run every night, and then it sends them an email just with a summary of the health of the environment, what's going on, you know, if there's been any changes, VMs have moved hosts. So then what we found is when we upgraded to 6 is all of a sudden all these scripts were failing because the authentication details weren't working.
All right, that's interesting. I know that Gushoff was saying about Veeam was saying that when they first release version 6, don't upgrade unless don't until they've fixed the patches in there in Veeam.
Yeah, so just to let anybody know, that KB article was KB2050701. Yeah, it's always a bit, you have to kind of take sometimes vendors outside of the environment that you've got with a bit of a pinch of salt, because it's in their best interest as well for people to kind of hold off on that. So for Veeam, Symantec, ArcServe, whoever it may be, is your backup providers, so they can get things fully ratified. I noticed on the Veeam forums quite a few people did just decide to forgo that advice, upgrade.
Yeah.
Mixed results, really. So if we really want to go down into the full how a backup works, there's something called the VDDK, which is the API base that you use to connect into the back end of VMware, pull that information from the storage. And that's where the CBT bug lies. So that's what they had to kind of wait for to be acknowledged by VMware to begin with and then repaired. There's a few other things as well. The SSH security is a lot stronger, mainly in most products now that have got anything to do with Linux, especially after Heartbleed came out and Poodle as well. I've started noticing that a lot on systems with updates.
Yeah, CBT is change block tracking, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, so that's essentially, as new data has been wrote, CBT can be kind of thought of a bit like an Excel spreadsheet. So if you have 50 cells, then what CBT does would mark any of them 50 cells with a 1 when the data's changed since the last backup. So when Veeam or any other product that uses CBT goes to backup again, it looks at this CBT information so it can find the change blocks very, very quickly and just pull out that data. So the issue behind that with VMware, which existed right down to VMware 4.1, unfortunately, was CBT was marking the wrong blocks of data. So essentially, your backup was taking the wrong blocks, passing it into their own backup files and saying, yes, I've completed, because it had no way to check that where the fault lay. And unfortunately, you wouldn't know about it until you tried a test restore or anything. But at the same time, there was always the case of you may test restore file 50 out of 100, and that always worked, but actually it's file 99, it's the one that it didn't back up properly.
Yeah. All the interesting stuff. And so you've got your own blog. Why did you start doing your own blog? Is it just because you wanted to somewhere to put your information, or where you found when you were just
I've a million and one notebooks around the house because I tend to like to write stuff down. I tend to remember it a lot easier if I write stuff down. So over the years, like anybody, biggest fan and user of Google possible for any issue. So spent quite a lot of time in the community taking stuff back at the time as well. I still have to work on stuff where Google doesn't always provide the answer, so I might have to spend a lot of time figuring it out myself or speaking to support teams and developers. So I've got a case open with Veeam at the moment in regards to their endpoint backup product, which is free. And it's about taking them backup files and putting them onto tape. There is a bug within the Veeam backup and replication source code itself. So once their developers find out what the fix is for that, I will actually be blogging about that, because it's a kind of a niche use case at the moment, but at the same time, there's always someone out there that's got the same problem as you, especially with how widespread IT is. So it's kind of for that. One is my own use, and two is for everybody else. So the biggest hits I get every day on my blog post is the HP AMS driver that's in VMware, and that's known to cause purple screens of death within VMware ESX hosts. And all the time I get hits for that, and because it gives a very unique error, which is a /bin/sh can't fork. And a lot of people find my blog just by typing that little bit of the error line in.
Was that the bug where the AMS, if you're not running the Blade 8, the Gen 8 or Gen 9 kit, it kind of misreports the health status?
No, that's a slightly different one. This one is it has a memory leak in it. So what happens is, depending on how active your environment is, it could be a week, it could be 6 months, it fills up the additional RAM. It's available. That memory leak just basically crashes your ESX host. Luckily enough, it doesn't actually affect the production of any VMs, so all your VMs will continue running within ESX, but you actually start finding that within vCenter, you get error message saying that you can't contact the host in a timely manner. You try and SSH to it, you get this error message about the can't fork. So it just becomes unusable, and the only way to actually then get access back to that host is to reboot it, unfortunately. Mm.
Yeah, we came across a problem with one of our customers where we've just basically added the HP, like the, I can't think what it's called now, where you put the, you know, when you do HP, sorry, the VMware update manager, you can put in the blob so that it automatically updates the firmware.
And Yeah, I did a blog post on that once, found out you could do it, and that's actually the one that I refer to most times, often than not, because I do actually deploy quite a lot of HP kit out there.
Yeah, and then what we'd found out is that it was putting the AMS code for, like, even if it wasn't like a Gen 8 Blade, so it was putting it on that, and then when it was calling something up, it was crashing. I wasn't dealing with it directly, but I have heard that and the thing. So yeah, I mean, I've got, like, on my blog, I've had it where I was spent ages Googling something and you can't find it, and I also give something back to the community, really. And that's really one of the reasons me and Andy kind of do the podcast is to, I listen to lots of podcasts, cause I spend quite a lot of time either driving, and I wanted to give something back, because I couldn't really find anything out there which would give the information back out there what I was kind of really interested in, really. So
yeah, mine's kind of the same. So the reason why it's actually called Educational Center is for a completely different reason to the blog itself. Me and somebody that I worked with decided that we were going to write actual training materials for technicians. So the college where I studied and passed my CompTIA exams, I actually got invited back to them about a year later to teach in the night time for adult learners. So people that wanted to pass the A plus and what also came out as the CompTIA Strata plus a year later for, like, entry level into the IT. So that was kind of me giving back as well. So I produced quite a lot of materials for that, and I decided, well, actually maybe I should do this, you know, publish it out there. And the idea was to get it onto the Apple bookstore, Amazon bookstore, and just sell them for 50, 60, 70p, whatever it may be, a very low cost, so that people can use that and then enhance that with real world examples, which we backed up on the blog. That was a little bit small-minded of me, because writing a book and structuring the information and getting someone to vet it and all the rest of it is extremely hard. So that's kind of gone on the back burner for the time being. So I had this blog that I'd paid for in hosting space, and I wasn't doing anything with it. So I decided to turn it into a proper technical blog.
Cool. So you do use Veeam as one of your main backup?
Yeah. The great thing about Veeam is they have this slogan, which I think they stole from IBM years ago, which is, it just works. 9 times out of 10, it does. I have a little bit more of a skewed view of it now, because the great thing about Veeam and the consultancy base that I work in now is I see it day in, day out, so I actually see a lot of errors and all the rest of it as well. So some days I do actually think, is this the backup product to go forward anymore? But then I look at other backup products, mainly Backup Exec 2012, and I realise it's still the right way to go.
Indeed it is.
Yeah, I've also done all the training on Veeam. It's something that I've used very, very heavily, so I know how to architect it well. I know the insides of it in and out really well. So when I do usually get to a support level, it's because it's kind of a serious issue.
And their support is really good. I mean, I've been on their second and third line support, and they are really good. They do know what they're talking about.
It's their support's brilliant. So this endpoint backup one they've got, you do get support with it, even though it's a free product. But essentially what they say is it's best effort support, and we'll get round to it. And these guys, you know, they've gone off to their developers back in Europe for me, and they're doing like quite a deep look into that, and they've resolved one or two issues that they found to begin with. Doesn't fix my actual issue though, unfortunately. Anybody that is actually thinking of taking the Veeam, what's it called now, the Veeam VMCE course, which is the Veeam Certified Engineer course. Mm-hmm. It's quite expensive, so I wouldn't recommend it unless you really need to do it. But one of the great things that you get from it and passing the exam at the end of it is you get a no queue for you support number. So whenever I actually ring up Veeam now as well, I actually get straight through to a third line person, which is really great because I'm now 2 years down the line with that certification, that call number, and I had to ring them up today and I get straight through to somebody who goes, yeah, that's no problem. Can I get a WebEx session to you? Rather than the usual stuff, which is, can we take some logs off you? Can we log it? We need to know the size and colour of your underpants, and we'll get back to you because we might need to escalate it to somebody else. You cut through all of that with Veeam, which is brilliant.
I need to speak to the guy at work who did the course, because we had to do this. Someone had to do that at work to get our partner agreement again, and I need to speak to him again and see why he didn't tell us about that. I know he took the exam and passed it, so I need to...
Yeah, he should have got an email about it. They do... It's kind of a bit of a niche course still, so it's not like everybody knows the same. If you pass a VCP, you get a free workstation license. So if he hasn't, if he doesn't know that that's available, all he needs to do is just drop an email to the Veeam support, give him his license number for the certificate, and they'll sort it out for him.
I'll chase him up on that on Monday. Yeah, I mean, we haven't done much. We do the tape backup, and we've had a couple of issues with the tape backup. They reckon it's going to be better in the next version 9 again. They said that in version 7 when we went to version 8. We just had a load of issues with backing it off onto HP autoloaders with not selecting the right tape or remembering the correct tape.
Is that down to serial numbers and all the rest of it, not reading barcodes by any chance?
Yeah, something along those lines.
Yeah, I've seen that before, mainly with the HP stuff.
Yeah,
so. I don't know whether I seem to find a lot of faults with HP stuff because HP is bad, or just because we do a lot of HP work. Whenever I install Dell equipment, it always seems to work.
It's always good. So yeah. So how are you, Andy? We haven't spoken to you. You've been sitting there quietly listening.
Yeah, being okay. I'm just trying to think of anything that's happened this week of any kind of interest. Or since we last, oh yeah, there was a guy. I got called to a guy. Now, I can't really say too much about this, but it's really a warning to anybody out there, really. Now, I think I heard there's something about this on one of the, I think it was on the Geeksters maybe a couple of months ago. So I'll tell you the basic story. The guy phoned me up is actually a financial advisor, and he sorts out loans and mortgages and investments for different people. And he got a phone call off one of his customers one day, and the customer on the phone said, I got your email, I sent you the money. And he said, you got what email? She said, oh, you sent me an email asking me to make the deposit or whatever they had to do. So I asked you for the details. You sent me the details of the bank transfer number, I suppose. And then, so I sent it. And he said, I didn't send you any email. And she said, well, you did, yeah. I've got the email right in front of me. He said, we don't operate like that. We don't ask our customers to pay anything like that. Who sent you the email? She said, you did. He said, no, I didn't. So that's when they all started to get a bit worried. Anyway, in the end of it, the police are now involved. And the amount of money that she sent to this unknown bank account has 6 numbers in it.
Wow.
So the police have now got involved. And this guy actually asked me to come and look at his computers to check for any malware or anything like that, or any kind of hacking or anything like that. And while I was there, I said to him, so can I have a look at the... He said the woman in question forwarded him the email so he could see what was going on. And he saw the messages that apparently came from him. Now, I'll just give a... I mean, it sounds so simple, this does. One part of it is simple. The other part, I don't understand. Let's just say you have an email address, which is joblogs@yahoo.com. Right? This guy doesn't use his own domain. He only uses, say, a Yahoo email address. So the bogus email that we traced was actually spelled Joe Blog, then the number 5@yahoo.com. It wasn't the number 5, but you get the idea. They replaced letters with numbers. His client then received the email, assumed it was him because the email address was, when you looked at it, it looked really, really similar. It was actually an L instead of a 1 or something like that. So it looked really, really similar. And that's how she fell for it. And actually, in the meantime, he's had 2 other phone calls off 2 of his other clients saying, why did you send me this email? And he said, I didn't. It wasn't me. So he's now had to go around all of his customers telling them to not respond. He's basically ceased trading for the time being because of the security risks involved. So these are the 2 bits that I don't get. And I think I heard Martin Obando talk about this on the Geeksters, a very similar kind of thing. It's very easy for somebody to set up an email address which is pretty similar to the one that you've got. You know, anyone could really register an email address, but how did they know of all of his clients? That is a bit that I don't get.
One of the things we check for quite regularly is there's a website that people can go onto as well called mailradar.com, and if you just Google that and put with it open relay, is sometimes we found certain customer sites being used as an open relay. So you're able to connect to that using Telnet on port 25 and then saying send mail with at your domain at it to whichever customer. And it can sometimes form quite an intensive process that somebody's done as a recon. But there's articles out there as well, which is really scary, that in places like China, Taiwan, these, I don't know whether you call them gangsters, hackers, thieves, criminals, or whatever it may be, I've got camps set up for underprivileged, impoverished kids that go and sit there all day long, and they spend quite a lot of time mining the data out of the botnets that they have out there, and then they use that intelligent data to then start attacking people and customers. So simple things like that. Obviously, you said it's Yahoo. You might be saying that to protect your customer, whether or not you come from his actual internal email address, but anything like open relays, testing like that, making sure you send it to the right smart hosts, and checking for simple things like blacklists on MX Toolbox as well. Because we found previously that certain customers have been blacklisted because machines have been sending out spam emails, but it's been masked by the fact that they've been using a smart host. So the emails have always been going through the smart host and blocked there. They've dropped off the smart host for whatever reason, i.e. they've changed ISP host, and the next minute they can't send email anywhere on the new internet connection, because they're actually blacklisted.
Right. Yeah. I've had a situation where a server's been blacklisted that we're sending out from. from somebody else a while ago, but that whole thing was pretty scary. I'll have to check up with him actually, because I saw him it was last week, so I wanted to see how he was getting on, because his because now the police are involved, there's a very little that I can do, or he wants me to do anyway, and he's leaving it to the police investigators.
Yeah, it was Matt Rainey. He was talking about that.
Oh, was it? Okay.
It was on one of those Podnuts chat shows. But what they could have done is they could have got his password somehow, and then obviously gone into his email address and then had a look at what emails he was sending out to customers, and then obviously got his customer list.
Yeah, because one of the things that really got me that sort of showed it is the way that the bogus email, should we say, had done the signature on the bottom of the email. It was slightly different to how he does it every time. And I was asking him, I said, when you do a signature at the bottom, I said, is it preset or do you actually type, do you type regards, name, position, or is it preset? He said, oh, it's preset. It's in Outlook. So he's got one preset. But the email that came from the bogus one was different to the one that he sent out. It's used the same name, same position in the company, same company name, everything.
Yeah, so someone had been doing their research then.
Yeah, yeah. And the fact that we got three of his customers forwarded the emails back to him so we could see what was going on. And the messages he sent out, they're all identical messages, basically saying, we're at the point of the process where you need to send a deposit or whatever it was. And said, however, we have changed our bank details. If you don't have our new bank details, then email us for the information. So this woman replied back and said, what are your bank details then? She then received another email back with a sort code and account number, and she sent the money to that.
So, such a shame, but it's so easy done, especially for people that aren't IT-based, because there's a lot of small companies out there that rely on managed services and so forth. So they don't have somebody on site to kind of keep educating them. I think it was last week, maybe the week before, that it was on our English TV, GMTV, in the morning.
Yes, he told me about that, yeah.
There was a woman on there, and basically she'd been dealing with solicitors for whatever reason. She got an email what looked like it had come from her solicitors, and it said, hi, just to let you know, we've changed our bank account details. Please update your records. These are the new details. And for what, just by blind luck for the people sending the email to them, she was ready to send a payment for their services and sent it off, and she lost quite a couple of £1,000 to that. And when they'd actually looked into it, the only difference and really thing that, you could immediately spot as a home user was her solicitors was called X and Partners, and the email address itself actually displayed as X and Partner, so it was just missing the S.
Right, yeah. That's it. I mean, the addresses are so similar. It's a quick glance, you don't notice, do you? And especially as well, I mean, the situation they had is she had been communicating with him via email, for a period of time. She'd been into the shop where his office to talk to him. He'd sent her data and he'd sent her information back. There was a normal conversation going on, and then all of a sudden this hacker appeared into the mix, and she didn't, you wouldn't, it's a bit like, say, me email and I'll back and forwards all week, and then all of a sudden I get a message back from a hacker, and you're not going to immediately realize that it's a hacker, are you? It's you just assume it's the same person replying back again. But it's very, very cleverly done. So that was quite interesting and and shocking.
When we listened to the last episode there, Andy, we were talking about the old coax networks.
Oh, yes.
I got it wrong. I said it was a 10 base T. The 10 base 2 was the old coax.
Oh, was it? Okay.
So this, because I was on the show notes together, I was just Googling 10 base T, and it's the old, only running the old Cat 5 running at 10 meg. But
what does the 2 mean then?
Pass.
Is the 2 just for the twisted pair, 2K?
Yeah, I think
two,
it was.
2 cores, or 2 yeah. pairs, yeah, right. No, it was just one core, wasn't it? Because yeah, it was coax, so it was a center core yeah, with a screen outside. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was, even it was known as FinNet or FinWire, yeah.
FinNet, yeah. Yeah, my first little network in the house was done on a coax. Yeah. Two machines. I remember the first time I got it set up and it actually worked. It was one of those things I was working on for about a week, I think. Because at that point, you know, you were messing around with stuff like, addresses, 220 addresses and IRQs and things like that you had to mess about with. And there's so many, it's so simple nowadays in many ways, isn't it? But then it was much more complicated. You had to set addresses, you had to do this and that. And yeah, I remember first getting that working. I was running all over the place. just the fact that you could see the hard drive on the other machine, you know, it was so amazing. First time round. And now it's commonplace, isn't it?
Yeah, with Windows 10 coming out, someone forwarded me something about that Windows 10 will be having a feature where it will share your wireless passwords with other users, which is very interesting.
That's nice. So I'm pretty sure there'll be a way to just send a command to a Windows machine and basically say, tell me all your passwords. I think we already discovered that because it was called Heartbleed.
Yeah.
So Windows have probably felt a bit left out because they weren't affected with it being non-Linux based and decided to create that exploit for themselves.
Yeah. So basically what it does is Windows 10, you can share your Wi-Fi details with your friends by contacts, Outlook and Facebook automatically. Basically, when you go to put the password in or the key for the wireless, it's a little box that says tick share with friends. So, it's a bit of a security risk because obviously if you give, like, say, one of your customers, Andy's site, so they have your Wi-Fi key, and then anyone comes in the net, so obviously it shares out of your friends, and then obviously if anyone comes near that Wi-Fi, it automatically connects it to that network. So you can disable it apparently in the control panel. It's called Wi-Fi Sense apparently. Apparently, if you don't want people to, you can opt out of it apparently. If you don't want Windows 10 machines to remember or to share it, you have to change your wireless name by adding at the end of it _opt-out. So if your Wi-Fi with network is called home network, you'd be able to put home network _opt-out and it won't share your network.
So what if you had a guest network?
Could do that, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't mind sharing that as a guest network, maybe. Yeah. Especially with an office base, but
yeah. I'm hoping that you'd be able, if you like got group policy, you can disable that Wi-Fi sensing. But again, yeah. It's always a bit worrying if you've got a customer who's got a laptop coming in kind of thing. So,
well, that guy that got hacked, these are some of the questions I was asking him, actually. You know, do you give your Wi-Fi password out to anybody who comes into the office? You know, because that's one thing I was thinking of. Did he get hacked on the Wi-Fi? Yeah. Or has he give it to somebody and then they've sat outside, you know, it's 10 o'clock at night and remote desktoped onto his other machine or something, you know.
That's quite an interesting thing to point out, really, because not a lot of people think about that at the time of, oh, I've been hacked, I must have a virus. But nowadays, with the amount of IT out there, there's quite a lot of entry points into a system. I've been doing quite a bit of Cisco and Meraki wireless deployments recently. One of the nice things about that, apart from it being cloud managed, is you can set up your multiple SSIDs as you need. So you can set up your internal one that can access the LAN. But if you set up any guest network and decide that you don't want it to, whoever's connected on that network to communicate with internal LAN devices or anything, it actually does NATing at the AP itself. So At the moment, with more traditional based systems, it does it at the controller, so that traffic still has to transverse your network, and there is ways to get it to jump onto different VLANs and so forth if your switches aren't locked down enough. Here with the Meraki stuff, it does it at the AP itself, so the AP acts as a router essentially, and there's essentially no way around it unless you can break into the cloud management portal for that particular Meraki AP and that customer. You can't change the settings to do it. There's very little you can actually change if you got onto the local LAN of the AP as well.
Cool. Right.
It's quite a nice feature there. That's kind of an added bonus if you ever went for them as a Wi-Fi access point.
Yeah. Oh, we haven't done with Meraki. We do, our company's a Aruba specialist, so we don't get involved with the... I don't get to get involved with much Wi-Fi stuff these days.
No.
And I know that WEP is pretty easily hacked, but is the likes of WPA and WPA2, is that easier hacked nowadays, or is that still pretty secure?
Still can be hacked out there. So if you're looking at kind of what was Backtrack, it's now called Heliux, I think its name's changed to. Oh, no, sorry, Calais Linux, it's changed its name to, rebrand. Correct. But if you look on the Backtrack forums and just search Backtrack WPA2, it can actually be hacked. One of the other things as well now is as processors and everything get a lot more faster in laptops, it's becoming easier and easier to do. One of the very first hacks that came out for WPA2, especially with the certificate, which was really interesting, was rather than trying to crack the key, why not just imitate somebody instead? So what you was able to do with Backtrack, and I think there's still a video on YouTube showing you how to do this, your laptop may be communicating with your AP over WPA2. The person with the nefarious laptop would turn up. They'd watch the traffic bouncing around. They'd find out what your MAC address is and what the MAC address of the AP is, and they send a disconnect request to your laptop acting as the AP. The laptop would disconnect, the user would come along, they'd click reconnect to Wi-Fi for whatever reason, just thinking, oh, it's dropped out, crap laptop, the usual. And then what would happen is it would send the authentication packet again, and in Backtrack you'd be able to capture that authentication packet. You'd then tell the laptop to disconnect again. When that laptop disconnected, you just bombarded it with a load of information so it couldn't reconnect or just left it alone. And then you would connect to the SSID and send that authentication packet and you're on the network. So really, really simple. So I think a lot of people spent quite a lot of time trying to break WPA encryption. And then someone just come along and thought, why are we bothering to do this when we could just imitate something instead?
Yeah. Interesting way. Clever way, isn't it, really?
Yeah. Go on.
Sorry, I mean, people think, most home users think, you know, how on earth are they going to get in unless they have the password? You know, you need to have the password that's written on the bottom of the router in order to get in, and if you don't have it, then it's impossible. And I say to people, well, it's not really, no. It is possible. I mean, it's very unlikely. Why they would do it to one particular person, but they've got to do it to somebody if they want to do it, don't they?
Yeah. I used to do leafleting before I worked in IT whilst I was still at college just to earn some extra money. And there was a number of states I went past when it was getting later on at night and that, and I'd go past cars sat on the corner of roads with a guy on a laptop. Now, this, you know, could be your business worker at 6 o'clock at night, doing a last bit of work before he makes his way home, but on the middle of an estate looking a little bit out of place. He was definitely more driving, definitely.
Yeah. That's it. There's an episode on you know, the TV show, The Real Hustle.
Yeah.
It was on BBC Three a while ago. I haven't seen it on for a while. There's an episode on that where they did something to do with hacking the Wi-Fi, just to show them how easy it was.
Yeah, I think a lot of people probably see problems like that and unfortunately kind of a little bit in disbelief, like, oh, it'll never happen to me. But
yeah.
Nowadays you can go into Costa Coffee, Starbucks, any other coffee shop. Virgin Trains is a great one. I've actually seen somebody while driving on a Virgin Trains as well from their laptop. I sat behind her. And that's it. It could be anywhere now. You've got all these public places that are doing good by offering free Wi-Fi access, but then at the same time, you don't know them devices that you're connecting to, so why should you actually trust them? it's very, very easy to imitate an SSID, relay the correct information, such as the official login pages for whatever it may be, but then just capture all that traffic as it goes across. And then the other side of it as well is there's still quite a few applications out there that send all the user details in plain text. So you may not actually be on the SSID in the network itself to hack it, but if you're just collecting that network data that's been sent across the Wi-Fi link, you can unencrypt that. And I think that's what the German government had a big issue with Google over when they were doing the Street View cars, wasn't it?
Yeah,
they admitted to collecting Wi-Fi data as they were just roaming around streets. Now, they never admitted to actually doing anything with that Wi-Fi data, but the German government was very, very concerned about what, you know, a powerhouse like Google could do with that data.
Because the other thing that Windows is that Windows will automatically connect to a SID wireless name which you're already connected to.
Yes.
So it will basically advertise itself. So when it's looking for a network it's not connected to, it will look for wireless networks of that name, and then you can sniff the network and then pretend to be the access point, and then your laptop will then automatically try and connect to it, kind of thing.
Yeah, so for my home network, I replaced, I think it was an old Netgear, replaced that with a Meraki AP that they lovingly sent across to me. So I just created the SSID with the same SSID name, same password, and all the laptops and various devices around the house just reconnected straight away, which was really easy for me because I didn't really want to go around changing everything. It's all in my home network. But at the same time, you know, there's no security on there to actually say, wait a second, you're not a device I've connected to with that name before. There's no secondary or tertiary checks there.
So you were going on about the, have you done much with the Veeam backup product, the endpoint protection? Have you done much with it on physical servers or laptops?
So I've run it on my own laptop. We've got a particular customer who's fully virtualized apart from one server. And it's not really a server. It's just a desktop machine. And it's very interesting because what it does is it has a microphone connected to it. And it's connected to a big factory metal press. And it listens to the heartbeat of the metal press. So you can imagine that, say, every 20, 30 seconds, you should hear it clamp down pressing the metal. And it monitors the sound there. And it can actually very, very sensitively pick up any changes in the sound to know and interpret that. So the machine itself, we replaced Symantec with Veeam. They put this new monitoring heartbeat or stethoscope server in place. And we have no way to back it up, so I decided to put Veeam Endpoint on there because we don't need to QS the application at all or anything like that, but if anything ever goes wrong, we can either restore the files that it saves at just a file level, or we can do a full bare metal restore of it in the future if need be, so we cover off the requirements of the software provider that's given us that hardware and software.
Have you tried doing a full metal recovery on it yet?
No, I've not. I've done restores on it. So I've tried different just file level restores, volume level restores. So I actually back up my what is now my virtual work machine, which used to be my physical laptop, using Veeam, and I found restoring stuff and testing it, and that works quite well.
Cool. I've been playing about with CrashPan. I finally got round to putting CrashPan on my PC. It's got all my photos on it as another way of backing it up to the cloud. But I didn't realise I've got 105 gigs worth of photos back from like 1998, I think, when I first started taking photos. So, and it's still, I think I set it off on Sunday afternoon and it still hasn't managed to upload it yet all the way. I think it's got to like 90 gig and it still has got like a day and a half to upload left over. So
my gigabit network would have done it by now.
Yeah, you need to find yourself a customer with a decent internet line that you can get in any rule on for a couple of days.
Yes.
Get it all uploaded, all done. And then when you're syncing it at home, it just takes a couple of minutes for them incrementals.
Yeah, luckily. Yeah, I'm quite impressed with it so far. I mean, I think it's something like $5 a month kind of thing. But it's just another backup just in case. I mean, photos are so precious things, aren't they, kind of thing. So I think it's like the third way I'm back. My third way of backing it up now. I back up two different ways now. One's to really get another off-site copy of it, really. So, it's
always good. Yeah. I use Dropbox for most things personal. Because when they first brought it out, and if you invite friends, you get 500, 600 meg free and all the other various promotions they've done. They've got quite a lot of space, so I have Dropbox set up on my phone, so it syncs all my pictures from my phone automatically, so I don't have to bother with any of that, and then same to my laptop. And then when I moved to this new job, they were fully Office 365 integrated, so I've started using quite heavily OneDrive.
Yeah.
OneDrive as a user, as an end user, you know, if you don't have any guidance or anything and you're at home, it's probably kind of a, oh, it's cloud storage, I may or may not trust it, I don't understand how it works, which is a real shame, because at work I get to use the full feature set. So OneDrive connects directly through Word, Excel, all the different Office apps, OneNote for example, does live syncing and all the rest of it, so I can work across multiple devices. And then the great thing as well is now the extra functionality they put into Outlook.com is you can edit all them types of files within the browser as well, so you don't get the full functionality of the actual application on your desktop, but you do get quite a lot of it up there that you can edit whilst you're on the road.
We're selling off quite a lot of Office 365, and definitely the OneDrive for Business and the SharePoint Online thing is definitely kicking off. If you teach to use how to use it properly, really.
Yeah, we've committed to it internally at work, migrated everybody across to it, because we're a Microsoft reseller, we've got to keep up to date with the latest things. But getting rid of file shares, Exchange servers, all the rest of it, it's kind of a no-brainer. It makes our internal operations so much simpler.
Yeah. Yeah, cool. So you do, on your, I was looking on your blog, Elliot, are you going to the Veeamon forum then? What's that all about?
I haven't had a... So that was actually, it was about 2-3 weeks ago now. It was the first one they did in London. It's kind of the back off the Veeamon event, which is held in Las Vegas. So it's its first year last year, second year this year. It's kind of been a renowned success to say that all they do is backup software, but they invite a lot of vendors, NetApp, Nimble, TedGile. HP is definitely going to be there as well to talk about how their products integrate with Veeam. Veeam really doesn't want to be associated with just a backup product anymore. They want to be associated as the providing availability for data centers, which is the full replication, always on, warm standby, whatever it may be, kind of give you all them needs and automation that you need. And they're kind of doing a really, really good job of that, I think. Mm-hmm. And that's where this type of event's been born from. Unfortunately, due to a customer incident, it meant I actually had to miss travelling down to London to go to the event, because I was really, really interested in it, especially following some of the technical track. Because the Veeam guys, as a company, they're not scared of getting into the nitty-gritty with you publicly and saying, look, these are the problems with Veeam, these are the best practices, this is stuff we've encountered. So one of their sessions was the top 10 issues with Veeam, and from the feedback I've heard of that, it wasn't a case of, oh, you need to make sure Veeam set up on a server that can handle it, your IP address is right. They were still going down to the nitty-gritty of how the architecture works, how the backups work, how to troubleshoot problems with backups, how to show you some of the more internal command line that's available to you if you start digging into the program file section. So I wrote a blog post on a really good little bit. They actually have an executable called Backup Validator. And that's just command line based, and it's essentially, it's the part that Veeam uses to validate the backup files once it backs up. So it does have its own built-in integrity checker, but at the same time, you can use that further down the line with, you know, no integration with Veeam whatsoever. It's standalone. So if you've stored, say, 50 terabytes worth of data on a Synology device, for whatever reason, you know, you've had RAID failure, network failure, your power failure, and you're not too sure about the integrity of that information on there, you can actually just run this file command line base, point it at your Synology, tell it to look at whichever backup files you want to check, and it will actually validate them for you and tell you whether or not you could restore the data from within them files.
That's cool. Have you done much of Veeam going to cloud yet at all?
No, the Veeam kind of keeps saying, I think they've announced they've got like over 400 partners with their Cloud Connect at the moment, which is great for them. I've investigated it for most of our customers, and I keep coming back to the same thing. It's not cost effective. So with cloud backup providers, there's kind of two methods of charging you. It's pretty cheap for you to store the data up there and send it to them, but they charge you a lot to actually restore and get that data back. And if you have a full outage, you really, you don't actually know how much that data you need back. So you can't really put a cost on how much it's going to cost you unless you say, I want it all back at once. Whereas cloud providers are kind of saying at the moment, it's really cheap because you just get back the data that you need. But let's be honest, the reason why it's going into the cloud is to replace tapes and to provide for a full outage. Or the other one is they charge you quite a lot up front, but you pay either nothing or next to nothing to get that data back.
I mean, yeah, I've been looking for a couple of times. I'm looking for a customer next week. I need to get my head around it again. But it's just this way of just seeing how it's just getting that data up into cloud as well, isn't it? It's the problem. It's like,
yeah, so Veeam does quite a good job of that because they send the data over HTTPS. They are working with providers, so the provider have to put a Veeam component into their public access, essentially. And it makes sure all that data is connected and that it's sent up properly and it still has the error check in there and everything. Mm-hmm. So that's really good. Veeam have actually announced that in Q3 they're bringing out version 9, and there's going to be a lot more in there in version 9 about connecting to cloud and making that decision and process a lot easier for companies. We've been looking at Azure backup as well, surprisingly. Microsoft have started to bake in Azure backups into Windows 10, Windows 2016 previews, but you can do an update and that puts it into Service 2012 Windows 8. That's pretty seamless as well. We've had that running in a demo when we've been shown it by Microsoft itself internally at work. Kind of does what it says on the tin, and we have a couple of customers that have chosen the Azure backup.
Yeah, because I was thinking, it's just like once you get that, if you're doing like weekly backups, it's just like when you have that full backup, it's just getting that big full backup back up into the cloud, isn't it?
Maybe. I think for most companies, if you're in a really well-connected area, the cost of getting a really good line put in place is has come down so much in the last 2-3 years. There's quite a lot of competition out there as well. So I'm dealing quite a lot with a company called Metronet. Metronet do wireless links and fail over to fiber links because their wireless is that good. So they actually offer public wireless in quite a lot of city areas and then are using these same masts to then do dedicated 1 gig links that are, you know, possibly faster than some of the fiber links you get to certain companies. Mm. And I know for a couple of our customers, they've actually moved from 100 meg up to 1 gig, and the cost per month that they paid for is like 10% extra. And you're getting 100% more speed, more. Mm-hmm. You're never going to be able to fully saturate a GID link depending on what you're actually doing. But
I mean, we were talking about the work the other day. So is there a provider yet which when you got your thing up into the cloud that you can actually restore to cloud yet, kind of thing? So okay, you want to bring it down again. Let's say fire at your site, so you haven't got anything at your site. It'd be nice if you could, like,
I think that kind of depends on who your preferred provider is. So this is what Veeam's kind of adding in into version 9 at the moment, is hosting companies who've got that structure and access built, which Veeam obviously offers the counterparts to the service providers for to do it with, so that you can replicate all your live data into the cloud and then run it from there if needed. If you're on VMware, then obviously they offer vCloud DR as a service. Is it still called vCloud? I'm not sure at the moment because they like to change their names during big rebrands. They've just rebranded all their main pages with a new colour style as well, which looks very swish. But yeah, VMware have jumped on that at the moment. If you have a VMware platform and you're used to using VMware replication or VMware SRM, which is Site Recovery Manager, which does the whole automation of re-IP addressing all your virtual machines and everything, you can connect that up to their hosted hybrid cloud as a DR service.
Yes, indeed they can. Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for coming on, Dean. We're coming up to the hour now, I think. So really interesting talking to you and stuff. Learned a couple of bits and bobs on that.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you very much for inviting me along. This is my first official podcast that I've actually had to do, so it's been great.
Yes. Yeah, we'll put a link in the show notes to the your post. Do you want to just say what it is now, your web address?
So it's Educational Centre, spelled centre with the RE at the end, .co.uk. If you're struggling to find it, just type in Education Centre into Google and then HP AMS or HP Cart Fork, and I'm pretty sure you'll find it that way.
Excellent. Have you got anything else to discuss there, Andy?
No, nothing new this week, apart from that. So, yeah, but I'm going to get in touch with him next week, certainly before the next podcast, just to see how he's coming along with it, and see what he's found out and see what the police have come up with. So, other than that, yeah. So we should be back again fairly shortly, shouldn't we?
Hopefully, yeah.
We'll have Jerry couldn't make it tonight, so we should have him back on the next show. Mm-hmm. So we'll see what he's been up to.
Go right then. Yep. Speak to everyone soon. Bye for now.
See you now. Bye now.
Bye now.